Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. It's great to have you here as always. How are you? What's new in your world? Are you finding ways to flourish? I hope so. Maybe you're doing something right now that's contributing to your growth or happiness or both. I hope that just listening into the show right now is a little act of looking after yourself, whether it's for fun, for distraction, or for learning, because I know so many of us here in the Potential Psychology community have a great love for learning. But whatever you're here for, congratulations on taking some time out for you. I'm really glad to be sharing your time with you. Now, before I introduce today's guest, and we are getting deliciously nerdy about power posing in today's episode, I thought I'd quickly share my three things with you. So there's something I'm reading, something I'm learning, and something I'm doing to fulfill my potential. And they're actually all tied up in the one thing right now, because I am, deep breath, writing a book or trying to write a book. It's a very slow process. As you know, if you too have written a book or tried to write a book, and I do know what I'm in for because I have in fact written a book before, would you believe, in 2005, which is, I don't know, close to a million years ago now, except I suppose it's actually about 16 years ago. And that book was called Turning 30, How to Get the Life You Really Want. And I actually co-wrote it with a colleague. And it was a very gratifying and torturous and challenging and also extremely rewarding experience. I had no idea what I was doing, but somehow an idea that this lovely colleague and I had over coffee in Bondi in the sunshine many years ago turned into a book deal through a literary agent, and that turned into a book. And that book was in fact published in a few different countries, the UK, Australia, the US, and even published in Holland and translated into Dutch. Although I've never managed to get a copy of the Dutch version, that's something I've always wanted to do. And I did, in fact, have the idea for this current book straight after we published that book. So way, way back in 2000, I suppose it was 2006 by the time it was published. And then life got in the way and somehow 16 years have passed and I'm finally working on it in a serious way. And in some ways, it's actually a great thing that 16 years have transpired since that initial idea, because I now have 16 years of additional knowledge and learning and experience that I can bring to this book, which can only make it a better product in the end. So sometimes good things take a long time. Well, at least that's what I'm hoping is what's going on. So to let you know what the book is about, it's not Turning 50, even though that is actually on my horizon. It's a book for new leaders. So workplace leaders, community leaders, maybe team coaches, even parents as household leaders. And it's going to help new leaders understand people and behavior so that they can feel capable and confident and able to have the kind of positive influence at work and in the world that I know they want, we want, we all perhaps want. So it's going to bring together all of my learnings as a workplace psychologist and consultant about how people function at their best in teams and in groups and what motivates them, inspires them, engages them, and how to help them to be their best so that they can and will do their best. And it's also going to have a lot about self-leadership as well. So how do we function at our best as individuals? How do we get to know who we are and have the confidence and self-belief we need to take on these roles of influence? And how do we make sure that we manage our own well-being in that and avoid the burnout and the overwhelm that can come so easily when you step up into a leadership role? So two elements, self-leadership, I suppose you might call it, and then leading others. And there'll be plenty of tips and practical examples from the so many wonderful teams and workplaces that I've worked with over the past 20 years, all there to help new leaders or to help you to put these ideas into practice and to feel confident that you're getting it right and making a difference for others and for the organizations or institutions or communities that you're helping to shape without burning yourself out. So that's my three things wrapped up into one. Rather than reading a book, I'm writing one. And of course, there's a heap of learning that I'm doing through that process, both in my own content area, ensuring that I'm up to date with all of the current research and knowledge, but also about the book writing process, because although I've done it before, it was a long time ago, and I don't know that I did it as well as I could have back then. So I'm absorbing the tips and strategies to do it better this time, to perhaps do it, I don't know if more easily is the right way, but with less self-torture, perhaps. And I do know that I can do it better this time with a bit of extra learning. And as far as fulfilling my potentials goes, well, it's been a project a long time in the making. And if I can pull it off, I will not only be thrilled to my very core, but I'll also gain all of the, I suppose, sense of achievement that comes with any big project that challenges that you have to strive towards. So that's my three things rolled into one. What are your three things? What are you reading? What are you perhaps listening to? What are you learning? What are you doing to fulfill your potential? I'd love to know. You can let us know over on the socials or via email. If you are a newsletter subscriber, the latest Potential Psychology update will be in your inbox. They come out with new podcast episodes. So if you are a subscriber, go check that out, have a read and hit reply to let me know what you're learning, reading and doing to fulfill your potential. And if you're not yet a newsletter subscriber, pop on over to potential.com.au and sign up so that we can stay in touch that way too. It is a much better way to have a two-way conversation because podcasts, as wonderful as they are, do tend to be a little one way. So join in the conversation by subscribing to the newsletter. Okay, so that's enough about that. We're on to today's episode, episode 98, in which we are getting our psychology nerd on, but in a very fascinating way. We're talking about power posing, which you might have heard of through Amy Cuddy's extremely popular TED Talk or her book Presence, or through the many, many leadership development programs or blogs or articles that spruik power posing as, I guess, a hack for building confidence and contributing to success. And you may even have heard me talk about power posing with Melanie Schilling, indeed that Melanie Schilling from Married at First Sight, about power posing in one of our very early episodes of this podcast, because we did do that. I think it was in our first season. So we'll link back to that episode as well in the show notes. But power posing has had a very interesting, has, I suppose, a very interesting backstory. And it's played a big role, interestingly, in psychology and psychological research over the past 10 years. And my guest today is here to explain all of that and more. So let's listen in. My guest today is Tom Loncar, who is an experienced coach and mentor. He holds an MBA from the Australian Graduate School of Management and a Master of Science in Psychology and Neuroscience of Mental Health, which is an intriguing topic, from King's College in London. He has more than 25 years of leadership experience across the corporate sector, the public sector, and small to medium enterprises. And Tom is also a contributing writer on leadership, to leading business magazines, which have included things like the Australian Financial Review, Boss Magazine, Switched On Leadership, Career Panorama, and recently, The Psychologist, which is the British Psychology Society's professional magazine. And for this, this publication, he wrote an article called A Decade of Power Posing, Where Do We Stand? And I read this article and I was intrigued and thought, what a wonderful thing to talk about on the show with Tom, because for long-time listeners, you might remember that Melanie Schilling and I talked a little about power posing way back in our first season over 3 years ago. It might be one to look up if you're interested. And it's been a fascinating topic in psychology. So we're going to get a little nerdy with this one, if you're ready. And I'd like to welcome Tom to the show.
Hello, Ellen, and thank you for inviting me. Great to be here.
It is, and it's great to have you here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I suppose we need to start with, well, actually, I'm going to throw you off guard a little here because I'm going to start. What got you interested in power posing? Before we even talk about what it is, what led you to write this particular article for the British Psychological Society's magazine?
Well, I've been aware of power posing over the years. Working as an executive coach, you can't really avoid it. It's very popular, and you hear of people going to offsites or leadership development programs, and the TED Talk by Amy Cuddy often being quite prominent. So, very inquisitive over the years, and I was kind of aware at a surface level that it was a powerful idea, but that had some controversy in more recent years. And in my sort of follow-up in the more general publications, my sort of inference was that Amy Cuddy, one of its key proponents, had refuted all of the questions, batted them away that had come up in more recent years. But then in my more recent academic studies, a topic in the dissertation was to look at controversies in our area of interest. And I was looking at interventions in the sort of the self-confidence domain for leadership. And in looking at controversies in this broader theme, I thought I'd dig beneath the surface of power posing, and suddenly all these various rabbit holes opened up that I wasn't aware of in my sort of more general knowledge beforehand. And that's where I started digging in, and that's what formed the basis of this article that you've described. 10 years of different rabbit holes.
Yeah, it is 10 years of different rabbit holes, and we'll go into some of those controversies in a moment for our listeners so that they can get a feel for just why this played a part, particularly in psychology and psychological research more broadly. But I guess we better start with a definition of power posing. What is it exactly that we're talking about?
Okay, at its essence, it's taking up an expansive posture, either sitting down or standing up, for up to 2 minutes, as a sort of a preparatory kind of thing before social evaluation takes place. So before job interview or a stressful meeting, that's how the original authors portrayed it. But in terms of the pose itself, the two key dimensions to think of are expansiveness and openness. So expansion in terms of how much space you take up. So if it's standing up, a wider stance. And in terms of openness, it's like, you know, limbs, you know, arms and legs open, not crossed or contracted, is the general gist. So 2 minutes of that should be enough to help you on a few variables of interest. And in the original article, there were three outcomes. So the outcomes they looked at were the psychological benefits, so whether you felt more powerful and in control. Secondly, there was a biological measure. Well, there were two of them, hormonal ones of testosterone and cortisol. It was found that they both improved in the right way. So testosterone, the hormone associated with victory, went up following a power pose, and cortisol, the stress hormone, went down. And also behaviorally, they set up a behavioral task to see how willing you were to take on adaptive levels of risk. So they did this through a gambling type of paradigm, and they found that people who did the expansive posture were more likely to take on this good level of risk. So three positive outcomes, all very relevant for when you're putting yourself out there in terms of a thing like a job interview.
Mm-hmm. And I think for many women, and maybe men as well, but I think many women, we relate to this idea of the Wonder Woman pose. So there she is standing there, you know, firm stance, hands on hips, shoulders back, looking like she's ready to take on the world or solve the problems of the world, which I guess is what she was there to do. And so you're saying that the idea was they had these people pose in these stances for 2 minutes and then have an assessment, or did, you know, the study was basically assessing those psychological, behavioural and physiological effects. Okay. And when was this original research done, Tom?
It was in 2010 and the paper came out in the Psychological Science Journal. And I should stress too, it was 2 one-minute poses in the assigned conditions.
Okay.
So those who went to the expansive move did one standing up, one sitting down, as far as I can infer, and those in the contractive condition did 2 in the contractive poses. But yeah, but 2010, 3 up-and-coming researchers from Columbia and Harvard universities, Dana Carney, Amy Cuddy and Andy Yap. And it came out, and those biological and behavioural outcomes were the ones that were particularly exciting for that audience.
And so why did we pay attention to this? Why was this a thing when there are so many psychological studies published year in and year out? Why did this one gain particular attention?
Right. Well, it had its big breakthrough in 2012 when Amy Cuddy branched off from her 2 collaborators with that famous TED Talk, which is now up to over 60 million views, which is quite incredible. And it was ranked 2nd for a long time, although I just checked a couple of weeks ago. It looks like it's just slipped down to 3rd in terms of the overall rankings. But it was quite a breakthrough. You know, such an impressive narrative provided by Amy Cuddy in terms of where the research had come from, the examples she used, but also her personal example of being a very promising academic student and then coming back from a conference with a couple of fellow students. She had a car crash and had a very severe traumatic head injury, which significantly lowered her IQ. So she really had to relearn everything with postural awareness, part of what, you know, of her journey back to, you know, the academic success that she became, you know, teaching at Harvard. But that TED Talk, in combination with her book, Presence, which came out a few years after that, really helped put power posing on the map. And it was probably around that time that, you know, I don't know specifically when I heard about it, but I'm sure it would have been through attention being drawn to that TED Talk. But also in the more general management literature and also general media, you know, suddenly we saw power posing hacks being proposed for the workplace, you know, articles on LinkedIn. But in the UK, there was quite a bizarre interpretation of it at the 2015 Conservative Party conference, when suddenly Theresa May and her colleagues all started doing some quite strange looking things with their legs in particular on stage, with investigative journalism there suggesting that it was a weird interpretation of power posing. And I don't think they ever came out and refuted that. So, but it's well worth the Google, Conservative Party power posers.
We'll make sure we put a link to that in the show notes so that people can check it out, along, of course, with the link to Amy Cuddy's TED Talk. So it sounds to me, and certainly listening, and as somebody who works in the leadership and workplace space myself, and I guess it's not just that domain, as human beings, we're always looking for a kind of an easy fix, a quick fix, you know, the silver bullet that helps us to overcome whatever challenge it is we're facing. And so I'm guessing that the idea of just being able to stand in a certain pose, you know, that's a pretty easy thing to do, to be able to stand in a certain pose for a minute or two, and then for that to potentially, or certainly being sold as allowing us to overcome our nerves, anxieties, perform better, you know, present better, really achieve, therefore, a number of our goals, whether that is, as you say, getting a job or being able to nail a presentation or being able to be perceived as somebody who is capable and confident and is on top of it all. The silver bullet, I'm guessing, was part of that little marriage of different circumstances that allowed this to really take hold in the public mind.
Absolutely. And one of the closing themes in that TED Talk is how this is a powerful tool for the powerless.
Mm.
And to spread the word on that front. So, yeah, and a lot of enthusiasm there for it. Yeah, but you're right, some problems inevitably emerged when it was seen as a one-size-fits-all panacea for the powerless suddenly becoming powerful. It ain't so simple. No.
No, it never is, isn't it, with the human beings? So we'll come back to that. But I'm interested, Tom, because this is all, well, I'm going to say relatively recent. 2010 is not that long ago in the whole great scheme of things. The idea of embodiment, this idea that how we physically present ourselves and how that might have an impact on how we feel, that's not that new, is it? That's an idea that's been around for a little while. Could you tell us a little about the history of embodiment as you understand it?
Yes, absolutely. And embodiment, the term tends to be used interchangeably with embodied cognition in social psychology. But the word embodiment has got a lot of different meanings across different contexts and in looking into it. And it kind of relates kind of to the same thing. But, you know, if you were to ask a neuroscientist or a philosopher to define it, they'd be probably a bit more complex in their definition than a social psychologist. But in social psychology, it tends to relate to the idea that our bodies influence our emotions, and remembering that's a bi-directional thing. So often we think that, you know, an emotion could be fear leads to contraction or some sort of bodily expression. But in embodied cognition and embodiment, it brings to light the bi-directional nature. So with power posing, it was like, the posture leads to the emotion of, you know, feeling powerful and in control. But that idea does stretch back in terms of the lineage in social psychology. It tends to stretch back all the way to the work of William James, the philosopher from the 1890s, who in his time was also a controversial idea, but he proposed that our bodies then influence the consequent expression of emotions. There's some quite evocative quotes from him that do crop up in the literature from 2010 onwards that relate to power posing. And Dana Carney, Amy Cuddy and Andy Yap in their original article do make a point of pointing out William James's ideas.
Yeah, and I find it's interesting, just on reflection, I interviewed Dr. Diana Hill, who works in acceptance and compassion therapy and training just recently for the show. And we were talking about the links. She also has a background in yoga training and teaching. And she actually got me to do a couple of little physical things where we're using the idea of embodiment, the way that we move our body and what impact that has then on our cognition, as you say, and our emotion, the three things being very tied together.
Yes.
And I know, and I expect this would be your experience as well as a coach, that I do use my reflection of somebody's body language, how they are appearing to me, both in terms of their stance, but also in terms of facial features and just what I call their energy, which sounds very woo-woo, but you know what it is and how it is they're appearing to me as a real signal in terms of their engagement with their motivation or an idea or perhaps a little sign for them of something that they might want to pursue further. Because often when you see somebody talking about something that really does engage, inspire, enlighten them, that is really matched well with their motivation and perhaps their strengths and interests that they might have a little bit of a blind spot around. But when they're talking about it, you do see them light up. You know, you do see their face change, their stance change, their, you know, shoulders back, they look up. So that's very non-scientific, entirely anecdotal. But it does feel from a number of different streams that there is clearly this link between our physiology and both the emotions and our behavior.
Yes, and I did listen to that episode with Diana. It was very insightful, great work there.
It was fun to know too.
Yes, and you make a good point too, like the embodiment literature in social psychology, it's not just about posture. It's how we walk and, you know, facial expressions, modification of breathing, for example. All that has been used in studies looking at how it can link to emotions and facial expressions in its own time is through the facial feedback literature and the famous pen in the mouth study by Fritz Strack from the 80s. That's been just as controversial as power posing in its time. And, you know, I think replication still being talked about for that original 1988 experiment. But that was the idea where if you have a pen or a pencil between your teeth and thereby activate the facial smiling muscles versus between your lips, more closely mimicking a frown. If you're exposed to some Gary Larson Far Side cartoons. If you're in the smile condition, you're more likely to have found those cartoons funnier. So, you know, preparing with a bit of a forced smile could work in your favour by feeling more joyful.
Yeah, look, which takes me back to, I'm guessing, probably first year psychology many, many years ago, and the Duchenne smile. Those are original studies that were done a long time ago where they'd show you, certainly as a student, they show you a series of faces and we're supposed to be able to pick whether or not somebody has their genuine emotion, depending on whether or not it's a genuine smile versus what they call this Duchenne smile, which is kind of the activation of the muscles around the mouth. So it looks like you're smiling, but they're not necessarily the eyes or all the other elements.
Right,
I think that was one of the first times I remember learning about this idea that how we feel is reflected in how we look. So that's that one direction, that unidirection, but then obviously a lot more research since on how it works in reverse.
Yes.
So Tom, you've mentioned controversy around the power posing research a few times. Let's delve a little further into that. What exactly was the controversy around something that had obviously become a very high profile, for psychology particularly high profile, piece of research?
The controversy really started in 2015, where a replication attempt by Eva Rainhill from the University of Zurich and her colleagues attempted to replicate the experiment, and they weren't successful on all of those outcomes. So that was 2015. And it's a little bit strange, or anyway, I'm curious as to why there wasn't controversy earlier, because these were quite big claims emerging. And digging into the nature of the experiment, it's quite a small sample, like there were only 42 participants. It was skewed towards females, and all of the participants were Columbia University students. So quite a sort of a small and narrow population from which to begin the power posing movement.
Mm.
So 2015, this first replication, so Eva Rainhill found that while the subjective psychological benefits of power posing, so feeling more powerful and in control, did replicate, they didn't have similar success on the biological or behavioral variables. And so with a couple of other replication attempts also not overly successful, power posing did unfortunately become embroiled in that broader replication crisis that was emerging for social psychology in 2015, where established domains of evidence, like, you know, research into social priming, for example, grit was also questioned, even growth mindset. A few replication questions emerging there. And so power posing became embroiled within that.
And why is, so we'll have a lot of listeners who are well-versed in psychological research and background, but we'll have some who are not so much. Why is replication important, and why is it sometimes difficult?
Well, psychology does purport to be a science. And if something is scientific, it should be, you'd think, it should be repeatable. And once you have a bit of clarity there, find out if it's more repeatable in some contexts versus others, like across gender, personality factors, etc. So really, up until 2015, there was kind of a thing where psychological journals would only publish positive results. So if you had a hypothesis and it didn't work out, you might not be encouraged.
They weren't interested.
No one's interested. Whereas, like, say, for argument's sake, say that you're looking at power posing and 99 experiments have failed. I'm not saying this was the case, but say that 99 mm-hmm. had, and then that 100th one worked, and that's the one that's published. So it's kind of giving a misleading read on what the broader scientific effort has been finding. Mm. And so lots of evocative metaphors for what was going on around then. Andrew Gelman called it the situation as researchers being in a garden of forking paths. So you make these little, you know, ideally you'd think if you're a scientist, there is the one true path to follow to get the result. But as it was, all these little tiny decisions that could be made along the way, in terms of, you know, maybe adjusting your dependent variable or adding in a new one, or, you know, deciding some results are outliers that you don't include in your main analysis, but you re-include them. So all of these little tiny adjustments. It's also been called researcher degrees of freedom in terms of how you play around with it. And Dana Carney, the original lead author of the power posing article in 2016, she came out with her own reflections on some of the, I guess you'd call them shortcuts or, you know, less than robust kind of decisions that had been made along the way for that original article. And that was to the extent that in 2016, she said that she did not believe that the power pose effects are real.
So it's fascinating as a bystander watching all of these events unfold and the continuation. This, as you say, you know, researchers starting to look and researchers can be very particular about each other's work. There is a level of competitiveness, as I understand it, and we can, and perhaps sometimes their own or each other's worst enemies. So there's a little of that going on within the profession and then within the scientific professions more broadly, especially around social sciences. Then there is this element of spotlighting, I suppose, people actually paying attention to some of these because these have been really very popular ideas in, as you say, the leadership media, in general media, growth mindset. You mentioned, I think there's been some work there around willpower as well, a number of these different topics at the time, high-profile researchers, high-profile topics, and then this kind of underlying question around the research and how replicable, if that's the word, how reproducible some of these ideas are. And power posing seemed to bear the brunt of a lot of that media spotlight.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure there's a lot of professional jealousy in there too. You know, if you happen to hit on the study that does touch a nerve in the general public, you know, your brand awareness is headed towards the stratosphere as it did for Amy Cuddy.
Yeah, and interesting because I think, well, certainly from my experience, this is a relatively recent phenomenon, certainly in the social sciences. You know, way back when, certainly when I was starting out, research just sat and didn't get nearly the media attention, the high profile. There were no TED Talks for researchers to be able to get up and really, you know, spruik their ideas and their discoveries. And as you say, for those who are particularly savvy, who are great with the narrative piece, for those who have had, I mean, obviously in Amy Cuddy's situation, it was a terribly difficult, traumatic experience that led to part of that narrative. But there's a little bit of art as well to being able to sell your research with a story to have that kind of impact. And then the book deals that follow and everything else. So a very interesting time for psychology.
Yes. And if you look at the underlying motivation, these people want to help people. So it's a message that they're keen to share, and there's some exciting platforms now for it.
Yeah.
But the other sort of contextual factor that was emerging at the time too was that, speaking of reproducibility, there was something called the Reproducibility Project run by Brian Nozick from the University of Virginia, and I think his group was called the Center for Open Science or something like that. But they got 270 researchers together, crowdfunded, aiming to reproduce 100 established psychological studies. And in terms of the success they had, it was 36%. So 36% of these studies that had been held in high regard, only that number were reproducible. And that study's report came out in the back half of 2015, which is just at the same time as that first replication fail for power posing.
Yes, I do remember that. Now that you said that, I forgot about it. But yes, and then there was a lot of media attention on that as well. And it started to pull into question so much of the research that we'd relied upon and built upon as a field over time.
Yes, and beyond sort of more civilized academic kind of debate on the merits of something like power posing via journals, suddenly academics had access to blogs on which to base their critiques. And Andrew Gelman, who I mentioned before in his stats modeling blog, has been quite vocal in this replication domain. So it was quite a change in academic discourse. And there's a really good article in the New York Times. I think it's called When the Revolution Came for Amy Cuddy. The writer of that speaks to some of the, or one person in particular who was very critical of Amy Cuddy. And the gist was they kind of didn't appreciate the downstream effects of the potential harm or the perception that it was, could be validly be seen as a form of bullying, of going for someone in this way.
Yeah, we forget sometimes that there are actual people behind a lot of these ideas and this work when we get caught up in the controversy, that there's a life and a human being with feelings sitting behind all of that. So, Tom, where did we get to with power posing? You know, it was a big thing and then it was a questionable thing. What happened next?
Right. Well, there's a couple of interesting chapters, but the first attempt to draw some kind of academic line under it was in 2017 in the journal Comprehensive Results in Social Psychology. And what they did was there were 7 pre-registered studies taking part in that, all looking to replicate power posing in as true a sense as possible. And Dana Carney herself reviewed all submissions to make sure that everything was as aligned as possible with the original intent. And so 7 studies came in 2017, and then there were quite mixed results in the individual studies, but what they did was they aggregated the data in all of them where it was possible, and they did a kind of a meta-analysis on that within this journal article, in a separate article at the end, over 1,000 participants grouped together, and what they found was, again, no, the biological and behavioural outcomes weren't replicated, but the feeling of power was. So that was now produced from a sample of over 1,000. So we'd moved from the teeny-weeny, tiny studies to a big one. So they suggested that let's accept this, and something significant was observed as far as felt power was concerned, and now let's look at how this might break down across different audiences. And they mentioned across gender, across, you know, personality factors. For example, does it work better for extroverts versus introverts, etc. So that was a kind of a bit of a civilized kind of like, okay, we've got to here. Now let's build forth from here. And so that was in 2017. But then there's been a couple of really interesting developments in the last 2 years, Ellen. The first one was in 2019, where Marcus Crede from Iowa State University, he had quite a pithy observation of the studies to date in this area, in that he pointed out that most of the experiments had been set up as expansive versus contractive comparisons, with participants randomized to either condition. But the fact is that we don't have or neglecting a neutral control. So any positive results, we don't know if they're driven by a positive result of the expansive pose or the negative results of a contractive pose, because we don't have that neutral kind of baseline. And so, very interestingly, the year after, Emma Elkjær from Aarhus University in Denmark and her colleagues, they actually did a huge systematic review and meta-analysis examining expansive bodily movements more generally, with power posing included. And they located more than 70 studies for their systematic review, of which about 48, I think, from memory, were submitted to a full meta-analysis. And that's where it gets interesting. So what they did was that they actually isolated 14 studies from their literature search, which did have a neutral control condition. So at the higher, higher up from the hierarchy of scientific evidence. And what they found was that in those studies where a contractive versus neutral comparison was possible, neutral versus contractive has a more positive result than expansive versus contractive comparisons, right?
Okay, yeah.
And that expansive versus neutral comparisons are not significant.
So it's not so much the Wonder Woman pose that's having an impact as the not being in those contracted, folded in on yourself, negative in inverted commas, style pose. So there you go. So it's not really a Wonder Woman power pose at all. It's just a not the opposite.
Kind of. I have stressed from the limited amount of studies to date.
Mm.
So there's a lot in the expansive versus contractive to date. That's where most of the effort's been focused. But from here, there's something going on with neutral versus contractive. And so future studies, let's start orienting further up the hierarchy of scientific evidence and get those neutral controls in there. But at this stage, it's quite a powerful thing. So grandma was right. Don't slouch.
I know, I'm sitting up straight now. Mm. Fascinating. And I mean, fascinating on a number of levels, not just around the power posing itself, but even just this as a good example of exploration around the scientific method, you know, a topic that probably pre-COVID and global pandemics, not nearly so many of us were as well versed in as we are now, largely around, well, certainly epidemiology is a word that most of us couldn't even say, let alone knew what it was or what epidemiologists did, but clinical trials, control groups, you know, so much more discussion around particularly the medical science. But to be able to then look at this as an example within the social sciences, within psychological science, to just explore the process, the fact that it is not a black and white, this is definitive, it's decided, or so rarely is that the case, that it is always a case of what next, what can we learn next, a process of curiosity and inquiry that just leads us to kind of shape our ideas around something rather than coming up with a definitive response.
Yes. And another important finding or recommendation from that last meta-analysis is that context is important. So getting back to what we discussed about power posing being wrongly interpreted as a panacea across all stressful situations. But what they did found was context is important. They found that attempting an expansive bodily expression where the experiment had an element of failure or an element of a negative experience for the participant, that the outcomes were quite stressful for the participants.
So what does that mean for us in practical terms? If we're thinking of using power posing, what are the risks perhaps, therefore, that this is suggesting might exist?
The risk is that treating it as something that will save you across all contexts. You know, if you're about to experience a dressing down from your CEO, do you go there in with, you know, hands behind your head, and you know it's contextually wrong, and it might make your situation significantly worse. So be mindful to the context, and you know, be prepared to be flexible. Deborah Grunfeld from Stanford's got some great ideas in this area, and it's about, you know, when to play high versus when to play low in different social contexts. So she does mention power pose as an example of a non-verbal of playing high, but it's not something that will suit you across all situations, or even within the one situation where you might have to be flexible and attuned to, you know, the ups and downs of where the dialogue's going in, you know, particularly when there's a few people involved with different roles, different levels of status, and what your goals are for that interaction.
So I guess what it's telling us, like everything to do with human behavior, it is complex. Context does make a difference. And I'm wondering whether there's an element of, when we sort of bring this down to the practicalities of how might we use as individuals our physical presence to have an impact on a situation or on how we feel about a situation, which is one of those variables that they did find was linked, then is there an element of just personal experimentation here, do you think? Is there a little bit of, I'm just going to try something new and see what happens?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, at its core, like the brilliant thing about all of this is that, even with the most recent meta-analysis, which kind of, you know, provided those numerous qualifications, but it does remind us that posture and our bodies are important. And anything that gets you out of your head and into your posture and that kind of in the moment awareness is a powerful, useful thing. You know, I'm sure in your coaching world, working with many busy people, you know, they often can get stuck in their heads, you know.
We all get stuck in our heads.
Right. And posture and, you know, physical awareness, you know, is an extra option. And in financial terms, options have value. So if you do have extra options for what you notice in yourself, others, and how you relate to them, it's a valuable thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's got me thinking then about, I mean, we've had a number of conversations here on the podcast around mindfulness, around breath practice. So many of our different areas of work in human performance are kind of coming back a lot to these ideas of our physical selves, perhaps more so than we used to talk about. And I know certainly having grown up and done my kind of management training in the 90s, none of this was on the radar then.
Absolutely,
we were all just in our heads and in financial analysis and spreadsheets and models and things. So many more of our conversations now are coming back to us as human beings and our physicality being an element of that, whether that is the way we breathe, whether it's eye contact, whether it is indeed posture, even for well-being. I do a lot of promoting, I think, of the well-being walk, as I call it. So just actually getting out and taking a walk, both for your self-care and well-being, but also due to some interesting research that came out of Stanford looking at creativity and problem solving and walking or just physical movement. I haven't looked at the research for a little while, but the underlying mechanisms weren't entirely clear, but there was certainly seemed to be a link between the act of walking and being able to problem solve in a way that's far more efficient than sitting at our desks and trying to problem solve in front of a computer, which is what we so often try to do. So advocating getting out there and going for a walk, which is just another element of our physical selves.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Tom, I'm interested to know what impact all of this immersing yourself in the research has had for you. Have you experimented with different postures and poses or just even become more aware of your physical self in different situations and the link between that and how you feel?
Yes, it's like I said, it's a great reminder about the importance of, you know, getting out of our heads. And like a few of your other guests, I also am a strong have a strong interest in acceptance and commitment coaching. Mm. And this whole postural domain is often an easy gateway into a proactive form of mindfulness, like, you know, you in the complex context that you're in, which I use in my coaching with my clients. That's the practical benefit. But also this study that I've been doing has just been a fantastic gateway into a real contentious scientific debate and, you know, getting to appreciate the changes that psychological science is now experiencing over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years since the replication crisis, as it was called. And a journal that, well, I subscribe to the Psychological Science Journal, and all studies there now do, there's a little marker for three areas, like, is the data freely available to other researchers? Are all research materials available too for anyone wanting to exactly replicate the study? And also, is the study that we're looking at, is it pre-registered? So did the authors commit to the line of inquiry and all variables at the outset? So it's a markedly different field now.
And like any crisis, I mean, they did refer to it as the replication crisis within psychology, like it was a disaster, a looming disaster, or a disaster that we were experiencing at the time. And yet I guess what that has led to, like many a crisis, is an opportunity for improvement. So those little indicators that you've given there around what is expected now from publications, that there is the opportunity, the data, the access that is required in order to replicate. So really what we've done, it wasn't a crisis after all, it was just a little opportunity, a point of disruption that provided us with a chance to improve practice and improve research processes, presumably for the betterment of the field overall.
Yes, indeed.
Tom, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. Thank you for all of the work that you've done to be able to. And I did say to you prior to us starting our recorded conversation today that for me, an appreciation of having this information, this quite complex conversation around not just the power posing, but the replication work and now the improvements, as we just mentioned, in a really succinct article that was easy to read. And I will link to that for all of our listeners who are perhaps interested in delving a little further, but to have it all in one space. So often, and fellow practitioners in the field would appreciate this as well, it's so hard to get a succinct summary that is unbiased, as you said, you know, presented without a particular point of view, just a summary of a situation. The research and being able to put that all in one place in an easy to read manner is rare. And so I very much appreciate that. And it was that that really launched this conversation where we've been able to delve into a little further. So I thank you very much for all of that work and for being here and for discussing it today with us.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, Ellen. And thank you so much. And keep up the great work with Potential Psychology.
Thank you very much. I will pop a link to lots of studies, lots of work, as well as Tom's article itself in the show notes for today's episode, along with, I believe you've also done an ABC radio interview recently as well on this topic. So I'll find the link to that and pop that in the show notes for our listeners as well, if they're interested in following up with that.
Great.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you, Ellen.
So how fascinating was that? Another great reminder that there is rarely a simple answer or a silver bullet when it comes to people or science, for that matter. We're all a fascinating work in progress, a lifelong discovery project, just like the research. And Tom referred to a number of studies and other great resources in this conversation that we've put in the show notes, including the links to Amy Cuddy's TED Talk, a great New York Times article about the whole power posing controversy that I do remember reading a few years ago. Tom's article for the British Psychological Society that prompted my discussion with him, and his recent interview with the ABC. That's the ABC here in Australia. So head over to potential.com.au to check those out. We've also added in links to quite a bit of the research that Tom mentioned. So if you've been enjoying getting your nerd on listening into this interview, then you might like to check those research papers out as well. And don't forget that the Potential Psychology podcast is now also on YouTube. You can hear and see my guests and I deep in conversation. So you can check out Tom and my interview. The link to our YouTube channel is in the show notes also, or just search Potential Psychology in YouTube. I think that's all from me this week. Stay tuned to our social channels, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, for more tips from the team and I on fulfilling your potential. We do have a new tip series coming up on the socials on successfully adapting to change. So periodically we run these tip series. They're always a lot of fun and seem to be pretty well received by our audience. We have lots of comments and feedback, which is great. And this current season, or the one that season, series, I'm getting my seasons and series mixed up, the one that's coming up is about successfully adapting to change, because so much of the world is changing around us right now. It seems moment by moment in both tiny and enormous ways. And while we can't control those changes, there are ways in which we can better prepare and cope and adapt and adjust to those changes so that we're thriving through them, so that we feel like we're moving through these experiences with intention and in a way that's helping us to grow rather than being dragged kicking and screaming through them. So we have all of the tips for thriving through change successfully on the socials. If you're not following Potential Psychology on LinkedIn, Instagram, or Facebook, you can find the links in our show notes for today's episode, or just search Potential Psychology on the relevant platform, or find the links on our website. They won't be difficult to find. It would be great to be able to share those tip series with you and to get your feedback and thoughts. And we're going to be back very soon with episode 99 of the Potential Psychology podcast, would you believe? That'll be in a couple of weeks' time. But until then, stay well and take big or small steps to fulfill your potential.